Good evening. When last we met, we were in Acts, the 16th chapter, and we ended at about verse 34. To very, very quickly review, beginning in Acts, the 16th chapter, verse 19, we saw that Paul and Silas got arrested. They were stripped of their clothing. They were beaten and imprisoned. In verse 25, we read that Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns of praise to God when a great earthquake struck. In verse 27, the jailer awoke, saw that the prison doors were open, and started to kill himself. In verses 28 to 32, we read that Paul stopped the jailer from killing himself, and the jailer responded by asking what he could do to be saved. And then in 31 and 32, Paul taught the jailer and his household the gospel. That leads us up to about verses 33 and 34, where the jailer's response is where I think we left off last week here at verse 34. The jailer's response was to take Paul and Silas and what they taught him and believe it. And that very same hour, he bathed their wounds, and then he and his household who believed were immediately baptized. And if faith was all that was needed, why would he have had to have been baptized? The fact that baptism occurred immediately reminds us of the Ethiopian eunuch, perhaps, in Acts 8, who, after hearing Philip preach Christ, said, "What doth hindereth me from being baptized?" And then after the jailer and his household were baptized, everyone then went to the jailer's own home, where he gave them food, and it was certainly an occasion for rejoicing. So, like I said, quick review. Any comments through 34? As we look at verse 35, "Now when day came, the chief magistrates sent their policemen, officers, some translations, saying, 'Release those men.' And the jailer reported these words to Paul, saying, 'The chief magistrates have sent to release you. Therefore come out now and go in peace.'" Well, the next day, the magistrates, let's see, King James Version says sergeants, and New American Standard, one of the latest versions, I think policemen, some of the others say officers, they send them to release Paul and Silas. And Vine says these words literally mean a rod bearer, one who carries a staff of office. The duty of these people were to attend these Roman magistrates and carry out their orders, administering punishment by scourging or beheading. The reason the magistrates changed their mind and decided to release Paul and Silas, we don't know. It's not stated. Perhaps the earthquake or thinking about the mob actions influenced their thought process. When the jailer tells Paul they're to be released, the words of verse 36, "Now therefore come out and go in peace," it seems they returned to the jail after going to the jailer's home for food and to rejoice over the baptism. So in verse 37, "But Paul said to them, 'They have beaten us in public without trial, men who are Romans, and have thrown us into prison, and now they are sending us away secretly? No, indeed. But let them come themselves and bring us out.'" After being told they could leave, Paul says, "No." As a Roman citizen, he deserved better treatment than he had received. Because I learned from Doug years ago, there's a Valerian and Porcian laws passed between 509 B.C. and 184 B.C., that exempted Roman citizens from degrading and shameful forms of punishment such as whipping, scourging, or crucifixion. Instead of leaving, Paul makes charges against the magistrates who sentenced Silas and himself, saying that they're trying to send he and Silas away in secrecy. Paul refuses to go. If they want him to leave prison, they need to come on out and talk to him and Silas and apologize. Vindicate Paul and Silas. Paul argues that their release should be as public as their humiliation. Paul says to these officers, Roman citizens were beaten publicly. That means Silas, like Paul, was a Roman citizen. The day before, the slave owners claimed to be Romans in verse 21. Now Paul says he and Silas also are Romans. Paul and Silas were not given a trial that resulted in a judgment against them. Roman citizens were beaten with rods, and that was a crime under Roman law. The magistrates cast Roman citizens into prison without a trial. This isn't good for the magistrates. After the policemen, officers, whatever we want to call them, reported what Paul said to the magistrates, they were afraid because the punishment for their crimes could include removal from office, loss of their Roman citizenship, loss of property, maybe even death. So they come to see Paul themselves and they beg them to leave the city. The day before, they publicly humiliated Paul and Silas with their authority. Today, they're begging Paul and Silas for mercy. So Paul and Silas leave the prison. They go to Lydia's, where they likely tell the brethren all that's just happened, about their imprisonment, about the baptism, about their release. They encourage the brethren. And since being in Philippi, they had preached to quite a few people, I'm sure. They strengthen the brethren. And after speaking to them, they leave the city and continue their trip. Any comments through verse 40? Okay, so now we're going into the 17th chapter. And as we go into chapter 17, we're going to see Paul visit several places after leaving Philippi. And they're going to include Thessalonica, Berea, and then Athens. And this next slide shows you inside the yellow circle, the area that we consider Greece, from Philippi up there, right under the letter A, roughly, in the slide. And as you look at this topographic map, you can see a lot of brown there in Greece, indicating that the country is rather mountainous. And in the north of Greece, that was, and over toward the west, that was very true. Paul visited several cities, including Amphipolis and Apollonia and Thessalonica and then Berea. Just to give you some idea what mountainous looks like in that area, those are all pictures from northern Greece. From Berea, they went on and traveled south toward Athens. So that kind of gives you a flavor of where we're going as far as geography of Greece. So as we get to the 17th chapter, the first three verses. Now, when they had traveled through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. And according to Paul's custom, he went to them and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and giving evidence that the Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead, and saying this, this Jesus, whom I am proclaiming to you, is the Christ. Paul left Philippi and traveled a day's journey of about 30 miles to Amphipolis and Apollonia, both of which were on the Ignatian Way that ran between Philippi and Thessalonica. This road extended from the Adriatic Sea on the western shore of Greece over toward Constantinople at the top above the Aegean Sea on the east side of Greece. It was a major road for that part of the country. In Macedonia, the route passed through Thessalonica and Philippi, among other cities. As I said a moment ago, they left Philippi and went to Amphipolis. I went backwards, didn't I? Excuse me. They went to Amphipolis and then Apollonia, and they ended up in Thessalonica. Apollonia was a day's journey further west than Amphipolis, about 30 miles. Thessalonica was about 37 miles, even further to the west. Verse 1 says that they reached Thessalonica, which was a city large enough to have a synagogue of the Jews. It was the largest city in Macedonia, was the capital city of that province. Thessalonica had a principal seaport in that part of the world, was a major commercial center, rivaling Ephesus and Corinth. And as verse 1 ends, we see that there must have been quite a few Jews living there in the city because they've got a synagogue. Verse 2 reminds us that Paul followed his pattern of preaching or teaching. More than once in our study of Acts, we've said that the gospel is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek by application. Of course, that quotes from Romans 1:16. Paul went first to the Jews in the synagogue and spoke for 3 Sabbaths. While this tells us what Paul did first, it doesn't tell us how long he stayed in Thessalonica. From 1 Thessalonians 2, verse 9, we hear Paul tell us that, or see Paul reminding the brethren in Thessalonica that he really labored and had hardship working night and day to not be a burden to them, as he proclaimed the gospel of Christ to the people in Thessalonica. And in Philippians 4:16, he said to the Philippians, "For even in Thessalonica, you sent a gift more than once for my needs." Those two statements kind of point out that it wasn't a really short stay. They stayed a little bit of time there, long enough for those gifts to come several times from Philippi and for him to expend great effort in Thessalonica. As we look at verses 2 and 3, it gives us an outline or an approach to how Paul speaks to the Jews. He had a prospect list, if you will, of people he could first approach to teach the gospel. Once he found a synagogue or located a group of Jews, he would teach them the gospel because the Jews had been tutored in the old law. Paul could use the scriptures to teach them about Christ. Now, note the action words used in these verses. In your translation, they may differ slightly, but verse 2 says he reasoned or explained to the people about Christ. In verse 3, he proved or gave evidence that Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead. He could take the Old Testament prophecies and lay them alongside the facts about Christ. And then it says, "This Jesus whom I am proclaiming," using Old Testament scriptures, "he showed Christ had to suffer and die and arise from the grave, as he proved Jesus was the long promised and now present and Messiah who had come to earth and conquered death on behalf of all of us." The Jews thought only of the verses that spoke of Jesus being a glorious king like David or Solomon. Paul explained that the true Messiah would suffer and rise from the grave of death, conquering death one time for all time. Wouldn't it have been wonderful to hear him speak? Any comments over these first 3 verses? In verse 4, "And some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas along with a large number of the God-fearing Greeks and a number of the leading women." It says some of the Jews, not all of them, but some believed, joined Paul and Silas in the work. In addition, there were God-fearing Greeks, that is, Gentiles, including many leading women who became Christians. The leading women might refer to positions that their their husbands held in authority, or maybe some role that these women held themselves. In the Macedonian towns, Philippi, Thessalonica, and Berea, there's a specific mention of women as converts. In verse 5, but the Jews, becoming jealous and taking along some wicked men from the marketplace, formed a mob and set the city in an uproar. And attacking the house of Jason, they were seeking to bring them out to the people. Verse 5 tells us that, much like what we studied in Acts 5:17 and Acts 13:45, some of the Jews have a pretty strong reaction to what Paul and Silas say. They don't like the success that Paul and Silas are having in teaching the gospel. Back in Acts 5, they were filled with jealousy. In Acts 13, filled with jealousy, began contradicting the things spoken by Paul. They were blaspheming. Those are strong reactions. And as we often see in Paul's travels, the Jews to whom the gospel was a stumbling block became jealous of Paul and Silas's success. They didn't like the fact that they were converting Jews and Gentiles to follow Christ. They went to the marketplace called the Agora. They brought together and gathered together a mob, and the marketplace was the heart of the city, if you will, the center of commerce, politics, and religion. And these Jews themselves then set the city in an uproar. And they target the house of Jason, with whom Paul and Silas had been staying. Verses 6 to 9 say, when they did not find them, they began dragging Jason and some brethren before the city authorities, shouting, these men who have upset the world have come here also, and Jason has welcomed them, and they all act contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, Jesus. They stirred up the crowd and the city authorities who heard these things, and when they had received a pledge from Jason and the others, they released them. Now, as you read through verses 6 and 9, they show that the Jews and the mob are lying by claiming Paul and Silas and the brethren are the ones who, in these verses, upset the world. Because that's not true. After not finding Paul and Silas, the Jews dragged Jason and some brethren before the city political leaders and accused them of aiding and abetting Paul and Silas by upsetting the world. That is, turning the world upside down. What the Jews did not realize was that sin had turned the world upside down in Genesis 3. And finally, the gospel was turning the world right side up. They present in verse 7 a second allegation to go with the first, and so saying in addition, and Paul and Silas aren't there apparently, in addition to causing trouble, they claim Jesus as a king, a rival to Caesar. You know, the same accusation was made against Jesus while he was alive in Luke 23, verse 2. The first charge was patently untrue, because it was the Jews, not Paul and Silas, who were causing the uproar. The second was a deliberate misrepresentation of what Paul and Silas had preached. Jesus is king, 1 Timothy 6:15. But his kingdom is not of this world, John 18:36. He's not a rival to Caesar in a physical sense like that. So the Jews that were making the uproar stirred up the crowd with accusations that suited their purpose, but didn't present the full truth, did it? When the charge is made that someone has named themselves a king, that's something the city authorities had to take into consideration. This could, you just, not just anyone can be a king under Roman rule. Verse 8 says, the Jews and the mob were successful in getting the crowd and the city leaders upset. They stirred them up. Imagine the yelling and the false charges that were being shouted, and the leaders were worried and that they would be held accountable for not defending Roman rule and authority. And as we read what Luke has written, it's obvious that the Jews instead are the source of the problem, not Jason and not the brethren, not Paul, not Silas. Verse 9 says that Jason and the others had to post some kind of bond called a pledge to guarantee that they wouldn't cause any more problems. Maybe this was some kind of sum of money. Maybe it was deeds to their property. The English Standard Version says they took money as security from Jason and the rest. You know, these Jews had a big misunderstanding. They did not seem to understand the difference in the physical and the spiritual. There is a conflict between the rule of man and the rule of Christ because they're diametrically opposed. John 15, 18 and 19 says, "If the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you." Those who accept the rule of man conceive the rule by an unseen spirit king, which we serve, 1 Corinthians 2:14 says, they perceive it as nonsense. They don't understand. 1 Corinthians 2:14 says, "But a natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them because they are spiritually appraised." I think that pretty well sums up these Jews that were causing the problem here in these verses. What are your thoughts through verse 9? Good thought. I think we're going to see a perfect example of that in the 18th chapter, which is one of my favorite examples, where the Roman ruler, Gallio, the proconsul, just wouldn't even hear the accusation against Paul. And the crowd dealt with that pretty effectively. So in verse 10 through 12, "The brethren immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea. And when they arrived, they went into the synagogue of the Jews. Now these were more noble-minded than those in Thessalonica, for they received the word with great eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see whether these things were so. Therefore, many of them believed, along with a number of prominent Greek women and men." There's a simpler map, maybe, where you can see these cities that we've been talking about. There's Thessalonica, and now we're down to Berea. In the face of great conflict, the Christians in Thessalonica sent Paul and Silas to Berea during the middle of the night. Under cover of darkness, maybe the rulers won't realize that Paul and Silas have left town. But once they do, what can they do? What can they say? They're not there to be dealt with any further. We've already mentioned 1 Thessalonians 2:9, Philippians 4:15 through 16, that indicate it likely that Paul and Silas did spend some considerable time in Thessalonica before all this happened. In my notes, I asked the question, is it wrong to flee opposition? Apparently it's not. You know, Paul did so. Matthew 10:14 says, "And whosoever shall not receive you nor hear your words when you depart out of that house or city, shake off the dust of your feet." Elsewhere, Matthew 7:6 says, "We should not cast our pearls before swine." You know, and if the people just won't listen, I think you go to fertile ground. Doug uses the analogy from the pulpit sometimes. We're to be seed sowers. And, you know, we need to keep sowing. Now Paul and Silas have gone to Berea. Berea was about 50 miles west, southwest of Thessalonica at the foot of the famed Mount Olympus. Upon arriving, they again go to the place where they can find Jews. That is the synagogue. As we said before, the existence of the synagogue tells us there's likely a good many of Jews there in Berea. Now notice the way the Jews are described in verse 11. They are called more noble-minded than those in Thessalonica. I think the word noble in this case refers to the Bereans being open-minded, fair, and thoughtful. Why? It says, "For they received the word with great eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see whether these things were so." Isn't that what we need to do each day ourselves? What do we put in the news and notes each week? We have a reading plan of the scriptures. What do we distribute in the track rack? What does Doug mention to us in sermons? Read the scriptures. Read the scriptures. Read the scriptures. The Berean test was they received the word with great eagerness. They examined the scriptures daily to see whether these things were true. Luke has identified qualities here, four qualities. They were receptive, they were diligent, they were cautious, they were loyal. They seemed like people, sound people, who would ask for book, chapter, and verse. Consider, in those days, they didn't have copies of God's Word like we do. Likely, they had to hear the Old Testament scriptures read to them and then meditate upon them. Now, as we live life under the sun, can we do any less than these Bereans? If we conduct ourselves like the Bereans, verse 12 shows the result. "Therefore, many of them believed, along with a number of prominent Greek women and men." Now, as you look at verse 12 and 11, what is always the key to spiritual growth? I'm going to suggest to you that daily Bible study seems to be a message in these two verses. Those who will do so demonstrate a sincere willingness to accept God's word, readiness of mind to grasp something that is worthy to be desired, and a willingness to examine the scriptures to get everything there is out of it. How many times have you read the scriptures? And when you're reading them, I don't remember it saying that. Or, I think I understand it better this time than I did when I read it before. Read and meditate. These people were very thoughtful in what they were doing. One of the greatest sins is to close one's ears and refuse to hear the truth. Matthew 13:10-13. God intended for us to know His Word, to study it, to examine the Scriptures. It's not a one-time thing. It's a daily duty. We need to be reading the Scriptures and encouraging that every way we can. From verse 12, daily examination of the Scriptures in a fair manner leads to belief. Searching the Scriptures with fairness brings us to understand God's will. What do we need to do? to live life under the Son. We need to understand God's will. And I think Sunday we heard John 15:14 or 14:15. They both basically say, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. Thoughts through verse 12. I really like those verses, I guess you can tell. Verse 13. But when the Jews of Thessalonica found out that the word of God had been proclaimed by Paul in Berea also, they came there as well, agitating and stirring up the crowds. Then immediately the brethren sent Paul out to go as far as the sea, and Silas and Timothy remained there. Now those who escorted Paul brought him as far as Athens, and receiving a command for Silas and Timothy to come to him as soon as possible, they left. From where does opposition to God usually come? It seems to come from religious leaders who hold to earthly forms of religion. Here it was the Jews, not the Romans, who opposed the truth. Verse 13 says, the Jews in Thessalonica found that Paul and Silas were preaching Christ in Berea. Think how great their anger, their whatever it was, must have been for them to travel from Thessalonica, about 50 miles west and south, to Berea, where they caused trouble again, agitating and stirring up the crowds. You may recall a similar circumstance in Antioch of Pisidia in Acts 13, verse 50, when the Jews stirred up the devout and honorable women and the chief men of the city and raised persecution against Paul and Barnabas and expelled them out of their coast. Paul and Barnabas then traveled the 60 to 90 miles to Iconium. In Acts 14:2, the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and made their minds evil affected against the brethren. After Paul and Silas had gone further east to Lystra and Derbe, we read in Acts 14:19 about the Jews like those in Thessalonica. They traveled from Antioch, Pisidia, and Iconium to Lystra and Derbe to speak against Paul and led to the stoning of Paul. The hatred these people must have, it's very strong. Then in 14, immediately the brethren sent Paul out to go as far as the sea, and Silas and Timothy remained there. They want Paul to be safe. His path led him to the sea, where a journey to Athens in the southern part of Greece called Achaia could be made by boat easily in about 3 days. If he traveled overland, it was about a 250-mile journey, and it would have been pretty difficult because of the mountainous terrain. And the only flat area as you go down that coast is near Thermopylae and that range of Greece as you look at a map. And that land trip of 250 miles might have taken 12 days, close to 2 weeks. Leaving Timothy and Silas behind, Paul was escorted by brethren to Athens. Upon arriving, he asked the brethren in verse 15 to send Timothy and Silas to him as soon as they can do so. So far on Paul's journey, we've seen on several occasions where he's met opposition from the Jews, and just reviewed some of those. As he traveled from Antioch of Syria through the area he visited on his first journey, then northeast to Troas, and across to Philippi and Thessalonica and Berea and down toward Athens. Paul has established new congregations of the Lord as he's traveled. He's taught the Jews first, and then he's taught Gentiles. And now he's in Athens. Any comments before we talk about Athens? Sherry. Sherry.
Control an area like the governor.
the gospel is meant to be understood. And I don't know if you've ever met people that just don't seem to be able to understand, but perhaps some of these Jews were so tied to a physical kingdom, they weren't willing to listen. We're not going to get very far in Athens today, but let's just talk momentarily about the city of Athens. It was named after the city's patron mythological goddess, Athena, the goddess of wisdom, and is one of the world's oldest cities and considered the birthplace of democracy. By the late 400s, the city population was thought to be about 400 B.C. The city population was thought to be about 150,000 people. It's located about 5 miles from the Aegean Sea. You have to go down to the port to see the actual boats. Commercially, olive oil, wine, pottery, beautiful marble were exported, and Athens was a cultural center and a philosophical center of the Greco-Roman world. It was known for its literature, its poetry, drama, theater, schools, buildings, government. Athens is called the birthplace of democracy, and our word democracy comes from the political systems used in some of those Greek cities. Now, that slide begins to show you roughly down in the southern part of Greece where Athens was located. It had the Ionian Sea to the west and the Aegean Sea to the east, and with just 5 miles separating it from the port, it had a great availability of water and trade in that area as well. Paul now finds himself alone in this great city of antiquity. Next Wednesday night, we'll look at Athens and continue it in the 17th chapter. Any comments as we close class? Thank you.